Hello and welcome to Brain Trust Live number 418.
This week on the podcast, Amanda Littman from Run for Something tells us why you should run for office.
And call in the brass band. We signed a bill. Turns out it is still physically possible to sign those.
Plus, a sprawling bill that will help all Americans is now headed to the Senate, where it will die because of the price of milk.
And World War II swim meets, Jimmy Carter sweaters, and other missives from Kevin McCarthy's 9-hour speech.
Plus, the legal system is broken beyond repair. That's it. That's what we have to say about that.
And Kamala Harris becomes the first female president due to a colonoscopy. In her defense, that's just as legitimate as the Electoral College.
We'll have all this and more.
This is Brain Trust Live. Hey y'all, I'm Brent.
I'm Lila, and you can find us on the web at www.braintrustlive.com.
Yeah.
And also, reminder to buy my book. It is a great gift.
We forget sometimes.
Some Kids Left Behind, available wherever books are sold.
Sometimes you forget, and then I have to do it for you.
Almost definitely always forget. It's the worst thing about being me. In any case, we are very excited for this week's episode because we have somebody whose work we've been admiring from afar for a really long time. As you know, we're a podcast about electoral politics, and so Run for Something has been a great source of information and data for us for a long time, and we are really excited to introduce the co-founder and co-executive director of Run for Something, Amanda Littman.
Welcome.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me. This is my favorite thing to do, so I'm excited.
Yeah.
Oh, perfect. We follow Amanda's Twitter account pretty obsessively, especially around elections. There's tons of information that will make you feel less hopeless after every election day where you have watched like 12 hours of CNN straight that has just told you about one top line race that Democrats lost. So we highly recommend that. But in any case, before we dive into the week's news, we wanted to talk a little bit about how Run for Something got off the ground. We like to make advocacy and political work accessible here. To begin, like, when did you start Run for Something? How did you start Run for Something? When you had the idea, what did you do to make it actually happen?
So I have always worked on campaigns. I worked for President Obama's reelect straight out of college. I worked on the Florida governor's race after that with a small stint at the president's nonprofit in between. Then I moved to New York to work for Hillary. And I stayed here after because it's nice here. I like my bubble. About a week after Election Day, I got a Facebook message from somebody I went to college with. Hey, Amanda, I'm a public school teacher here in Chicago. I'm thinking about running for office because if Trump can be president, it seems like anybody can do this. They keep cutting our budgets. What do I do? And I didn't have an answer for him because at the time, if you were young and newly excited about politics and wanted to do more than vote and more than volunteer, there was nowhere you could go that would help you. And that, to me, felt like a symptom of some really big problems in the Democratic Party. You know, a lack of focus on young people, not just as voters, but as leaders. A lack of focus on local politics, which is where shit really gets done, and a lack of an interesting bench of talent for the future. So I reached out to a whole bunch of people with an idea. What if we started an organization that could solve this problem and that would help young people run for local office, ultimately yielding a bunch of other good stuff in the process? One of those folks I reached out to connected me ultimately to Ross Morales Ricketto, who's been my co-founder and co-executive director and has been working in campaigns for about 15 years. We wrote a plan, we built a website, and we launched Run for Something on Inauguration Day nearly 5 years ago at this point. And we really thought it would be small. We thought we'd get maybe 100 people who want to run in the first year. What a cool hobby this would be. Instead, we got 1,000 people who signed up in the first week. And as of today, we're up to nearly 90,000 young people all across the country who've raised their hands to say they want to run. So not a side project anymore.
Not at all. That's amazing. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned all those candidates. We just, as Lila mentioned, you know, it seemed like the off-year elections that we just had with the Virginia governor's race, the New Jersey's governor's race, it seemed like everybody, you know, was running around as if things were on fire after that happened. And maybe to a degree, we should be acting that way because we have midterms coming up. So I feel like having anxiety helps in many instances, just get yourself ready. But you had a lot of candidates running and they did pretty good. Mm-hmm. Tell us.
Yeah. How many candidates did you support in the last cycle?
So we had 271 on the ballot on Election Day. Over the course of the year, we had about more than 400.
Wow. That's...
And of the 271 that we had on the ballot on Election Day, we're still waiting on results for a couple. There's one that's like literally tied vote for vote. There are four who are still in recounts and or runoffs. And then we had more than 131 winners on Tuesday, November 2nd, if I have that right. More than half women, more than half people of color, about a fifth LGBTQIA+. They include just amazing, amazing people like Justin Bibb, the new mayor-elect of Cleveland, who is a 34-year-old nonprofit exec, young Black man, super energetic, super passionate, has a really incredible vision for what Cleveland can be. A not-so-fun fact, Cleveland is one of the poorest cities in America. So it really matters to have good leadership there. Just last week, Dr. Aditi Bustles in Columbia, South Carolina, became the first Indian American woman elected in the state of South Carolina. She's a public health researcher and a new member of the Columbia City Council. We had Mary Weinberg win a seat on the Cincinnati School Board. Mary Weinberg is an Olympian, which I just think is really cool.
That's cool.
She's a gold medal Olympian. Nice. Indira Shoemaker won a seat on the Des Moines City Council. She beat out a 16-year incumbent. She was running on a platform of defund the police and a really aggressive, progressive vision for what Des Moines can be.
Brent's hometown.
I have a note to ask you about her because I had seen that news and I was like elated by that because I grew up in Des Moines. So
I think it's like, you know, I could do this for hours, but we had so many amazing women, people of color, young leaders. In Boston, Kendra Hicks in District 6, Ruthie Louis-Jean on the at-large. In New York, something like 16 or 15 members of the New York City Council will be run for something alum. It's just incredible people who knocked doors, made calls, talked to voters, gave a compelling argument for why voters should want them to win, which is not why they want to win, but why voters should want them to win. And were able to win even in places that may have voted for Trump in 2020 or 2016, places that may have also elected Republicans, but they were able to eke it out. And I think it's just a testament to what happens when you find good people, empower them to run good campaigns, and trust them to know how to talk to their voters.
Well, that's one thing that, especially just because, you know, I was going to ask you about Indira Shoemaker, but, you know, it seems like when I looked at what she was running on, I was surprised that she got elected. But then, you know, I think that we talk a lot on this podcast about sort of like candidates do better when it seems like they really stand for something.
Right. When it seems like there's a platform that they're trying to sell.
And I feel like she is an example of that, just in that she really, you know, didn't sell herself as anything other than, you know, truly herself. And I think that sometimes candidates can shy away from that, you know, and, you know, listen to whatever other, you know,
donors
potentially,
big
or
money.
Whoever else might be in their ear at the time. So I just
state party officials who have been in office, been in their seats for one
I'm curious,
trillion
do you,
years.
Do you guys look for specifically progressive candidates like that? Or is it just, does it end up being that way by nature of
right, dealing with young
that
candidates,
just,
dealing
you're looking
with
for
new
young
candidates, dealing with, you know, people that are newly excited about politics?
It's a little bit of column A and a little bit of column B. Part of it is that because we work with people aged 40 and younger, most of them are pretty progressive. Although I will say the definition of progressive changes depending on where you are. You know, a progressive in even in like Des Moines or in Brooklyn is going to be a little different than a progressive in Montana or Texas. Sure. So we try and operate from a place of values. We want people who really share our values. And there's a lot of different ways that those values can show up in public policy. But I think the thing that we really push for is candidates who can really answer three key questions, you know, beyond some demographic stuff, beyond some the first time folks, they're running for local office, you know, are they 40 or younger, all of that. We really want candidates who can identify what is the problem they care about solving? How does the office they're running for give them a platform to solve it? And why should voters want them to win? Which is different than why do you want to win? You want to win because losing sucks. Voters want you to win because of what you're going to do for them. So when you get candidates who can really answer those three questions cleanly and with passion and with, you know, enthusiasm, even if it's not the most eloquent, even if it needs some, you know, refining, those three questions make up a campaign strategy. Because then it's just a matter of how do I communicate that? Like, tactically, do I knock doors? Do I do it over the phone? Do I do it on ads? Who do I need to talk to about it? But you're not trying to decide what it is that you want to say in the first place, which makes everything else so much easier. And I think you can see why that matters, you know, on larger scale campaigns. When the candidates can't clearly articulate what it is they want to do for people and why they're in it in the first place, you know, campaigns get to become very messy because you start debating what it is this person even really believes.
Yeah, I think that's something that I think that's sort of a brand of politics that specifically with young voters, I think, does not resonate well. You know, we sort of we're watching young voters like who are looking to solve very specific issues in their lives that, you know, it's the lives of millennials and Gen Z where we have like no money and we're in debt. And, you know, there are like some very specific, like tangible issues that make it hard to resonate with a campaign that's just about how they are like not Republicans or, you know, whatever we're sort of like accustomed to seeing often in really, you know, high level campaigns that fail to deliver. And I actually wonder, I wanted to talk a little bit about bench building, because that's, you know, on this podcast, we have been complaining for years about the kind of the lack of focus on bench building that we've seen from both, you know, the national Democrats and then also at a lot of, you know, a lot of state level parties and local level parties as well. We had Laura Packard on the podcast a few weeks ago who was talking, you know, when we asked her, like, what do we need to do to get, you know, more things passed, to get, you know, Build Back Better passed, to get healthcare reforms passed. And she said, we need better candidates. And we started talking about the importance of primaries. And so we know that like your organization is really like a behemoth in the world of, you know, bench building. And so I wondered if you could talk a little bit about what you think state and national parties could be doing better to support bench building, and also like what you guys are, I mean, what you guys are doing beyond what you just described, specifically to ensure that like the candidates that you support have the support they need to continue, you know, in politics. Well,
I try to be generous in the way that I assess this, because I know that everyone is working from a place of scarcity, that right. state parties are wildly underfunded, county parties even more so, that this is really hard. Candidate recruitment, especially pre-2016, was really hard. And that most of these places are working from a viewpoint in which they have to decide, where is the most efficient way to spend my resources? Is it winning a Senate race or winning three school board races that are wildly different and really like different kinds of candidates, different kind of campaign messages, different voters, different states of play?
Sure.
So it's hard. And I think a lot of these parties have operated from a place, because it's hard, of how can we make it easier? That has meant historically recruiting people they think can win, which becomes tautologically both true and false at the same time. If you only recruit people who you think can win, and then they do win, you prove yourself true, but you've never opened the door to anything different. If you think they can win, if you don't think they can win and you don't recruit them, then you prove yourself true again. I think the conversation about electability we had through most of 2019 and into 2020 around the presidential election is happening every day on these local races. And what electability has meant historically on the local level is rich old white men. Usually people who are independently wealthy or have access to funds because they're trying to raise, you know, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 from their friends. We've worked with a number of state parties, one of which I'll never forget, told us they were looking for candidates to fill state legislative races. So they opened high school yearbooks in the district and looked for the football coach and thought the football coach would be the ideal candidate. You know, that's not unusual. All that's to say is that most members of Congress, most governors, most senators get their start in local politics. You know, think about the squad. For every AOC who didn't, you have Ilhan Omar, who was a member of the Minneapolis City Council, Rashida Tlaib, who was a member of the Michigan State House, and Ayanna Pressley was a member of the Boston City Council. Like, these people didn't come out of nowhere. The ones that do are pretty rare. So you need to make sure that the people on these local elections and in these local positions are the best, in part because that's also where Republicans get their nightmares from, because they have really understood. So one of the things Run for Something has been really focusing on is, and part of the reason we focus on young people is because when you get a 25 or a 30 or 35 year old elected to local government, they have more time to build experience. They have more, you know, space in their lives to climb the ladder. I read some really interesting studies at one point that talked about the reason we haven't had a woman president yet, is because most women waited until their kids left home to run for office for the first time historically. And when you start your political career in your 60s, it's just a little different. So one of the things Run for Something is really focusing on is ensuring that our candidates and our alumni, the people we endorse who go on to win or who go on to lose, but run really strong campaigns, often ahead of expectations, are in the conversation. So we work behind the scenes with the D-Trip and Democratic Attorney General's Association and with state parties to ensure that as they're looking to fill holes in recruitment, that they know our network is there and we're able to facilitate connections that way.
And that's really, I was just gonna say that's really great, because I do feel like, you know, you said something interesting in there. When they try and find candidates they think that they can win, you almost, you know, I feel like we get through a lot of election cycles, at least through Congress and the Senate anywhere, where you sort of see the formation of like a prototype candidate. Yes. That whatever, you know, when sometimes it's in reaction to whatever's going on, or, you know, sometimes we end up where everybody that year has to be a veteran for them to have been endorsed by the party or whatever, you know? So I think what you're doing, you know, is so additive just because it is, they're giving them options that are maybe not the prototype candidate. And that is good.
One of the things that we have really sort of ingrained into our organization mentality is that we don't know shit. The most important thing is to know what we don't know. And what we don't know is who can win. What we do know is that when you empower candidates to run strong grassroots campaigns, anything is possible. Anything can be become competitive overnight, whether the Republican gets indicted or a scandal breaks or all of a sudden the rules change or something happens in the news. So we really try to empower candidates, and then, as scary as it is, trust voters. And it sucks, and sometimes it disappoints, but I think it's better than assuming we know what the outcome will be before we even get started.
Right.
Yeah, I think it also encourages a mentality among campaigns to think that it is their responsibility to reach out to voters, as opposed to the voters' responsibility to just vote for them no matter what. Because I think that's something, you know, that is a sort of frustrating dynamic in a lot of campaigns that we talk about a lot on this podcast, is the dynamic of campaigns feeling like just because the other option is terrible, they don't really owe us an explanation for why we should vote for them in particular. And like that often just leads to, you know, voters disengaging, because like, why am I getting excited about a candidate who doesn't even give me the sort of generosity of trying to explain why I should vote for them? And I actually wanted to talk also briefly about one thing I feel like, just sort of extending from what you just said about sort of creating breaking the prototypes for what people think about as electable. This is something that specifically I noticed like around 2016, people kept telling me that either a woman couldn't be elected president I was like, we've never tried, so there's no way for you to know if a woman can be elected president. Like, this is not a talking point. And then again, you know, around the Warren candidacy and the Harris candidacy in 2020, we heard the same thing, people being like, oh yeah, I do like Liz Warren, but like, a woman just can't be elected president, as if, you know, we tried one time basically, and they were like, never mind. But I wanted to ask a little bit about some of the data that I know that this is not like scientific data in the sense that you are like running every campaign in America. However, I feel like, you know, just as I said, like I was able to send your election night thread to my mother to make sure that she didn't just like sink into a hole of despair, because you had numbers that showed that historic candidacies were succeeding in places all over the country. So I wanted to talk a little bit about the importance of that kind of data as we think about how to better support inclusive elections, like what that data can offer us.
Yes. So there's some broad political science research that shows when women run, women win at the same rates as men. The same is true with LGBTQ candidates. The same is true with people of color. The things that get in their way, generally speaking, tend to be our own damn selves. It's people deciding early on that they can't win, so denying them access to fundraising, to expertise, to operational support, to endorsements. All of that is a choice that we, and I say we broadly meaning, you know, party operatives and funders and activists and people who pay attention to this stuff, which is a very small number of people, but a pretty meaningful number in terms of the impact. All of that then creates the sense of a narrative. What Run for Something has seen over and over and over again, cycle after cycle, is that people who you don't think can win do, and do so because they outwork their opponents. They're usually, if not always, outspent. They are never outworked. We've had young people of color win from in nearly every state. We've had winners that include people of color. We've had young LGBTQ folks. win. We've had trans folks flip seats red to blue. We've had a young woman win in the oldest, whitest, most rural district in one of the oldest, whitest, most rural districts in America, up in Maine. In fact, we've had her do it twice, flipping it red to blue, first from the state house and then the state senate. That's now State Senator Chloe Maxman. And do so on a climate campaign, no less. Oh, wow. So, you know, I think we don't give voters enough respect. And one of the things that's really surprised me over the years is every cycle, year over year, because remember, something operates in a every year is election year, framework. So some people think of cycles like 2 years. For us, it's basically like 3 months. so we always have elections. Is we have candidates who will tell us, I went and knocked on a couple doors this weekend, or thousands of doors this weekend, and I met voters who told me I was the first politician to ever knock on their door. First Republican, first Democrat, first any. First politician to ever knock on their door in the 30 years they've lived here. And I remember specifically, we had a young Muslim woman running in DuPage County, Illinois, Hadia Afzal, who told me as she was knocking doors when she was running for county board, and she wanted to talk to people about their property taxes, which is a thing that people obviously, homeowners have a lot of skin in the game there. And she knocked on the store, and this old independent guy told her, you're the first person to ever ask for my vote. Republicans think they have my vote in the bag. Democrats think they don't have a chance, so neither of them try. And I don't agree with you on most things. In fact, I don't agree with you on anything. But the fact that you showed up at my home and that you were willing to have a conversation with me person to person about my taxes, you got my vote. Like, it sounds so cheesy and earnest and even idealistic to say this, but I think we miss the fact that so much of politics is about building a relationship between the voter and the person they are delegating to make the hard decisions on their behalf. And that is not a relationship that we take lightly, and that the way to do it is just giving people a chance to get to know these people, to get to know their leaders, get to know the decision makers. It cuts through so much of the bullshit, of the Fox News, of the Sinclair media, of the sort of online crap, when you can really have a conversation. That it is cheesy and it is idealist, and it's also really effective over and over again.
Well, especially in these... In these local races, also.
Mm-hmm. So there's no media markets to really be working with.
Not to say that our Senate candidates shouldn't also be working really hard, right? But I mean, you really in some of these, more local and even hyper local races, you really can sort of do that type of work and use it as your way to a win, I'm assuming.
Well, probably. And that kind of work really pays dividends too, because it increases turnout over time as well. I know that my parents are involved in the town council races in this tiny village in upstate New York. And like every year more people turn out to vote there just because they found candidates to run against the people that were running unopposed for like village board or town council or whatever year after year. And like every year 100 more people vote. And that is a meaningful difference in a town that only has 1400 people in it to begin with or whatever it is. So it's sort of a great long game strategy as well. It's an important long game strategy.
I mean, elections do not happen in a vacuum. What happens in 2017 affects what happens in 2018, which lays the groundwork for 2019, which gets you to 2020 and beyond. We have found, and we've done research that shows this, that simply contesting state legislative races in places that were previously uncontested increases performance for the top of the ticket by anywhere from 0.5% to 3%. That's field margins. That's
right,
that's meaningful.
That's wild.
That's data that also makes sense, but... is like, mm-hmm. You have to be running local candidates to get that data in the first place, but that's meaningful data that no one was referencing before it existed, right.
Before we dive into the news from this week, which we're excited to have you join us for, I'm curious, what would you say to anybody who's thinking about running, and what should they do? How do they reach out to you?
What's their first step?
Yeah. Pitch some new candidates who are listening to this podcast.
That's right.
If you're the kind of person that listens to this podcast, you're the kind of person we need to run for office. You care, you're engaged, you're participating. Giving a shit is 90% of the battle. We can teach you everything else. So if you go to runforwhat.net, you can enter your address. You can look up what offices are available to you to run for in 2022. Whether you're ready now or you're ready 5 years from now, so many of the people we worked with in this cycle in 2021 signed up with us in 2017 and 2018. Cool. We think about this in terms of the long game. So if you're thinking maybe not in 2022, but possibly 2023, 2024, 2025, 2030, you know, if democracy survives that long, we will be there to help you. So,
let's make democracy survive that long, guys.
There we go.
Let's try it.
We would love to help you.
Yes. All right. Fantastic. All right. Let's do it.
Let's talk about the news.
Let's talk about it. There was some this week, guys.
Last week there may have been news. We don't know because all we did was go over the Mayor Pete documentary.
Okay, we reviewed.
However,
Mayor Pete.
This week, well, first of all, you can get your COVID booster, so just do that. That's not news in the electoral politics sense, but it is news in the saving your life and not dying in the gutter sense. So, like that, like
do it immediately.
It's a good place to start.
Yes.
And then the other big news of the week was that we had one of the more elaborate signing ceremonies I have ever seen. And I want to note that in 2019, I was invited to a signing ceremony at the White House by the Trump presidency for a piece of legislation. I feel a little sad, actually, because I feel like that's maybe the one time I'll ever be invited to the White House. And I obviously couldn't go because, like, I wasn't going to go celebrate Donald Trump signing anything. But this really, this put that event to shame.
Right.
And that event had people in uniform at it. I mean, that was a real situation.
Yeah.
So, in any case,
they delayed doing it so people would be back
to have a more elaborate event.
Yeah,
they needed a photo op.
There
is no signing of an infrastructure bill that no one's entirely sure what it contains without a photo op.
Yeah,
that's the most important part of the messaging. To be fair, it is actually the most important part of the messaging process. I would say
it is
in a lot of ways because I think this bill in particular has not been well messaged because it's sort of been playing second fiddle to Build Back Better. And so, as you know, it's sort of been like the bipartisan, less glamorous, more confusing, lower budgeted ugly stepsister to a discussion that we've been having to infrastructure year that we've been having or infrastructure. I don't even know. It's because it's hard to know.
We've been calling it infrastructure season.
Infrastructure season kind of extended into infrastructure a quarter, and then it was like it.
At the signing ceremony, Rob Portman spoke because he was one of the Republicans who, was able to cut half of the money that was initially slotted for this out so it could be passed as a bipartisan bill. But he gave credit to Trump for bringing up infrastructure. Like, as if Trump invented the idea that we as America should be fixing our crumbling roads and bridges.
So bleak. So bleak. So fragile.
To be fair,
so sad.
So proud.
He did create a kind of pomp around infrastructure that I don't think existed before. Because we celebrated fake infrastructure weeks for years.
We had a lot of infrastructure weeks.
I mean, so there was a more celebratory atmosphere about infrastructure while also no infrastructure needs were being addressed.
Yeah.
So that's something I guess we could say that Trump did if we were forced to.
Mitch McConnell did vote for this. But did not go to the signing ceremony. And voting for it is actually what got Trump to call him an old crow. Do you remember this?
Oh, yes.
Remember when he called him an old crow? Like, what is that? What is that?
That's what an old man would call another old man.
I guess
that's
so.
I feel like sometimes Trumpisms are are sort of like old-timey insults that have been repackaged into like a chaotic chaos of of narcissism, if you will. Like, that's
sure.
I don't know exactly how to describe what I'm saying, but I feel like sometimes his insults are very old-timey and yet fresh and new at the same time. And I don't know how he does it.
I don't think Trump has a sense of humor, but calling McConnell an old crow is very funny.
It is.
I would argue that Trump has a sense of humor. It's a very bleak sense of humor that is also generally not funny and mostly at other people's expenses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Right.
But I would say that sometimes our interests align because his interest in himself his interest in himself caused him to hate Mitch McConnell, which is a thing that we all share.
Right.
So
I too. Yeah.
Bringing everyone together. Donald Trump. That's what we always say about Donald Trump.
Oh, yes.
It just brings people together.
That's right. Yeah. In hatred of somebody.
God.
I'm
curious though, how are you, we're going to talk about Build Back Better in just a second, but I'm curious how you feel the messaging about these bills has been so far. Could it be better? What could we be doing better? And also, do you think specifically on this infrastructure bill, which is the physical infrastructure, roads, bridges, broadband, do you feel like that's a meaningful thing that the Democrats in 2022 are going to really be able to rally around and sell?
No, I think the messaging has been bad.
I'm shocked.
Because, like, I am a literal professional political operative and a professional Democrat, and I'm not sure if that I could tell you accurately what has been happening over the last 6 months in Congress.
Yeah.
And like, the more that you learn how the sausage is made, the less you want to eat it. That is especially true with legislation. I do think that there's some really good, meaningful stuff, and it depends how quickly they start to implement it. Depends how aggressively Biden takes credit for it. You know, I think one of the things we learned in 2010 with the stimulus stuff and with healthcare, or 2008, 2009, 2010, was that people aren't going to know we did it unless we tell them 100 times over and put our names on everything. Like, there's a reason that local politicians put their names on all the signs and the trash cans and the bridges. It's because that's how you tell people you did it. So if you need to make every bridge and every road the
Joseph Robinette Biden
Skyway
or something.
Do it. Put his name all over it. Put those shiny aviators all over the place. Yeah.
That's why Donald Trump wanted his name on the checks that went out to people.
Listen, that's why Donald Trump put his name on Walman Rink, a rink that he was not an owner of, but just operated for a few years.
Where is this?
In Central Park. They finally just took his name off Walman Rink. You guys, I can finally skate there again. My dreams have come true. The end of the Trump presidency has ended one problem that I was facing that was more present to me than infrastructure. And that was, can I skate in Central Park? And the answer is finally yes.
Yeah.
But he put his name on it.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think that obviously it's going to take some time to implement some of the stuff, but hopefully they can at least get out there. And I think Biden is like going on the road this week and started even last week. I think he was in Michigan and New Hampshire and various places last week. So I agree with you. I have always felt like this was the bill that is less easy to sell to people. I mean, people obviously love infrastructure and they love getting a bipartisan deal done. But like, you know, I feel like there were a few instances when some of, you know, like Josh Gottheimer was talking about knocking on doors for, you know, for Phil Murphy, and was talking about how everybody was just really desperate to make sure that the physical infrastructure bill got passed through Congress immediately. And it was like, Josh Gottheimer, all due respect, nobody told you that. Like,
also, like, voters, most Americans don't use the word infrastructure. They use roads, they use potholes, they use bridges, they use airports. Yeah. Like, make my airport experience better.
Right. I think what's an easier sell, though, is we're going to give you universal pre-K.
Right.
Or we're going to bring down your prescription drug costs.
Here's a tangible thing that isn't theoretically a part of the road that you pass every day, but is in fact an everyday concern of yours.
Yeah.
Well, it's like I would love to live in a world in which doing really good, meaningful legislation directly followed like election results. But we are in such a circumstance right now where it's not enough just to do one good thing. You have to do so many good things and also fix the system upon which we're running elections. Like, sure, maybe infrastructure is great and maybe enough. It will win us like 2% of the popular vote. But as it turns out, we need 7% because of the combination of gerrymandering and voter suppression. So,
right.
Cool.
Well, that brings up an interesting question that we were debating whether we were going to ask you earlier today, because we weren't talking about voting rights, but we actually just did a segment on a podcast recently where we were talking about whether it was a mistake for Democrats who have not done voting rights. And granted, they passed H.R. 1 in the House, and I know they'd have to get rid of the
Well, they like they pass everything like, in the House. You can pass anything in the House.
Exactly.
Passing things in the House is the equivalent of putting out a press release. Talk to me when there's something real.
Right, exactly. Right. But do you think that was a mistake to not try and deal with that more meaningfully? As
or
a
prioritize
first...
that over this, like, do you think that infrastructure was really the sort of the one thing they should have attempted to accomplish? Or would you say that should have been something else?
I think it's a big problem that we did not prioritize democracy reform, because we're running out of time, because Republicans have already gerrymandered the map such that they can take back the House easily in 2022. And that doesn't even take into account some of the voter suppression laws, plus the hellscape that is the Republican takeover of local election administrative apparatuses in key states. Like, I think we're going to look back at 2020 and 2021 and the failure to pass democracy reform as like a what the fuck were they thinking moment when we're all hanging out in the great Commonwealth of the Acela corridor in 5 years.
Well, I like that you're calling it democracy reform, too.
That's good. And it's not even democracy reform. It's saving democracy.
Saving democracy protection. Right.
But
I think
roads are nice, too, I guess. It's good to get out.
I know.
Well, it's also, I mean, H.R. 1 was supposed to be their priority in 2018, too. So, like, the fact that they, for... for an additional two, like pushed it 2 years, and then in the year of January 6th, chose again not to prioritize it, knowing that even the sort of basic, you know, factual underpinnings of how elections operate were under attack, is, I think, an interesting choice on their part. A telling choice. Let's talk about BBB.
That also passed, again, the House.
In the
we
House.
We got a press release.
Yeah.
Amanda Littman from the House.
We did. We got a press release.
A confusing press release, because one thing about passing it in the House is that I feel like 25% of Americans are just like, we did it, and then do not follow up. And then later, when they don't have the stuff, they're like, nothing works. Democracy doesn't work.
Right.
No, you're you're joking, but that's such a big problem, and that we promise to do things, we make a big deal out of doing things, and because people don't feel like the impact, because they don't feel like that touches their lives, they get further disillusioned. It's actually really important to make promises you can keep.
Yep. This is something that Brent actually, well, I've been stealing this idea all over town. Brent thought of it, but you know what? I'm sharing it with him. But he was talking about on a podcast we did a few weeks ago about the importance, you know, like if you cannot deliver anything to your constituents, if you make promises, if you promise them prescription drug reform for 20 years and never deliver on it ever, the democracy reforms become less meaningful to them. They have less investment in protecting a system that doesn't serve them than they do a system that is delivering results for them. So, you know, we've talked about this a bit in reference to executive actions that they are not taking in the Biden administration, you know, things like canceling student debt and, you know, things that they could conceivably figure out how to do. But part of making those promises and not delivering on them is that voters end up with less investment in the system that we are desperate to protect, that allows them even any say in what's going on, and it becomes sort of its own self-fulfilling prophecy.
Which, the thing my co-founder Ross says quite a bit is that Democrats are the party of government, and the most important thing we can do to further the party's brand, which we talk about a lot in like the discourse, is to make government seem effective.
Yes.
By actually making it effective. So,
right.
You know, on everything from student loans to small things like DMVs operating well and voter registration being an easy and seamless process, to, you know, how easy is it for you to appeal to your city council to get a restaurant license? You know, on every level, the better government functions, the more people associate it well with Democrats.
Totally.
And when government makes big promises and then instead just, you know, basically gives you a big old like raspberry nothing, it's
also
really
when they
hard to take it seriously.
Small promises and then still can't deliver on those. I would not say prescription drug reform should be a big promise, because it affects almost every American, and there is only one industry that is you know, that is sort of like invested in protecting the way that prescription drugs work right now. But like the fact that like very specific tangible issue that Americans are experiencing is like unsolvable.
Yeah.
Is fascinating to me. Not that fascinating, because we all know campaign finance reform is really the main issue of all the issues. But fascinating just because it's such bad messaging if they can't actually deliver on it.
Yeah.
To
I will say there's a lot of stuff that if they can get through the Senate, like the world's biggest if, right? And we're going to talk about all the many reasons why that's, you know, we're going to dunk on Joe Manchin here shortly. So I'm sure that will be exciting
get ready.
For everyone. You know, I mean, there's universal pre-K in here. There's childcare subsidies. There is they're extending the child tax credit. They're, you know, it's the largest investment in clean energy, whether you think it's enough or not. I mean, you can still say that it's
some
the largest.
On this podcast might argue it's not enough, right? But that's just this podcast.
It also had paid leave in it out of the House, which we know that Joe Manchin doesn't like and is probably going to get killed in the Senate, amongst who knows what else will get killed when the Senate gets its hands on it. But, I mean, this, at least to me, has always felt like, and I have not really loved the messaging on this either, because, you know, I feel like we've focused almost entirely on the price tag of this so much, like how much is it going to cost? And first it was six, and then it was $3.5 trillion, and then it was 1.7. Now, and nobody has, I feel like we're just now, like months later, getting around to being like, oh, there's pre-K in there. You know, like I have always felt like they should be calling that like the universal pre-K bill, even though there's other things in it, you know? I mean, it's just like,
branded as something very specifically positive that people want.
But that to me feels like something that if they can pass, they really can take out to people and sell, at least in my mind, more so than we're going to fix this road. But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong.
No, I think you're right. I'm so down on the United States Senate. Like, I every so often I'll be like, It's just the worst country club, and we should just abolish it. We should abolish all of the country clubs, including the United States Senate, because what good is this group of mostly old people who do not seem to get it, that this is a crisis, that there are people who are suffering and they don't seem to care. And the fact that we have Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema determining basically the future of the American people is just like, fuck this noise, you know? I don't know if I can curse on the show, but like, fuck this noise. It sucks.
No, it's true.
You can
true.
Definitely curse on here, well, and you're telling this to two Californians. No one hates the Senate more than California because we basically don't have any representation in it, so...
Right, we have, right.
No, we're here no, for you.
Yeah,
just
abolish the Senate.
I'm curious, actually, based on what you just said, though, because I was listening to one interview of yours, and you said that you have to show people that you understand their anxieties. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's so important for all candidates to do, but seems to be something that, like, so many of our United States senators have a total inability to do.
Well, they don't understand people's anxieties. They haven't met any people.
Well, I mean,
recently.
I'm curious about, you know, I mean, that statement.
Joe Manchin
really...
lives on a houseboat in D.C. He doesn't understand people. He is not in touch with West Virginians. Like, West Virginia is one of the poorest states in America. People are struggling and suffering there. Totally. Everything that we talk about to help people in poverty, you know, yes, it will absolutely help racial inequities. Yes, it will absolutely help communities of color. But it will also help West Virginians who desperately need
totally.
It.
Totally. Well, and this is what I'm going to skip ahead and go on my inflation rant now because it seems
do
like
your inflation
a place.
Rant. Brent's been excited for his inflation rant.
Well,
all week.
We talked a little bit about inflation last week, but we sort of like didn't really dig into
well,
it.
Well, we had
right?
to get to the Mayor and, Pete documentary,
right,
Brent.
Exactly.
We were busy
last
week.
That was what was important. But, you know, Joe Manchin, one of the reasons why he has been so hesitant to say whether he's going to support this or not is because he's really worried about inflation right now. And look, inflation is high. I'm sure people are worried about inflation. But in his mind, you know, the reason that we're having inflation is certainly due to some, you know, COVID-related supply chain issues, right? But also, in his mind, it is in somewhat related to also the fact that we gave people money, right? We sent them checks. We're giving that we gave them, you know, an expanded child tax credit. So they now have more spending power. So they are buying things. And then because they have more spending power and there is already this COVID-related supply chain issue, that is what is causing the inflation.
Right.
So his solution is to not do anything additional for the social safety net. So essentially,
keep people poor.
Yeah, essentially his solution, when you boil it down, is to make sure people don't have enough money to buy goods and services.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Joe Manchin way. He's got his Maserati. He doesn't need us to have any more.
I mean, that's just an insane stance to take as for any single human.
Right.
I mean, but certainly a United States senator who represents some of the, you know, one of the poorest states in the country. Yeah. It's insane.
But this is what almost all conservative economic policy boils down to, is that there sort of have to be there have to be people suffering, or like the system doesn't work. I mean, that's something, you know, we like to make the comment on this podcast that the economy is fake. That's something that my grandfather, who was an economist and taught economics, you know, at a university for his career, first told me, and I was like, you can't say that. And he was like, we're charlatans, Lila. We don't know what we're talking about. But I mean, like, I think people like Joe Manchin like to act like the economy is some like force of nature that like nobody can control, that just happens around us and we just have to like roll with it. And it's all, we made up all the rules to it. We can decide how it works. There's like no reason that it like can't work with people having the ability to buy milk. Like it's not like that's a law of nature that we can't, you know, we can't figure out our way out of.
Yeah.
So I think part of his like, it's like a learned helplessness that is not a learned, I mean, he made it up. It's a made up helplessness, but like it's a convenient helplessness that he likes to lean on so that he doesn't have to legislate in ways that, well, that make his donors and himself hurt. But that like very specifically goes out of its way to not say what it's actually saying, which is that in order for the system as I see it to work, you have to be poor. Somebody has to be poor. Someone has to be suffering in Joe Manchin's economy in order for these laws of nature to like even themselves out. And he conveniently ignores that as a United States senator, he might be someone empowered to change what the laws of nature are.
Yeah, the other thing that drives me completely batty about this whole idea, and I believe that people in West Virginia probably are complaining to him about the price of some goods and services. I'm not here to deny that. But this idea that, like, you know, some things at the grocery store going up is what is going to ruin people's, you know, economic lives is not true. What the problem is the reason that they're so scared about the price of milk is because they're already hurting at other parts of their lives, right? It's because their healthcare is so expensive. It's because their prescriptions are so expensive. It's because they're already not making a living wage, right? Like, it's not milk going up $1 a gallon that is ruining people's lives in West Virginia. It's just that they already
they
are
don't
screwed.
Have a dollar,
right?
Because of healthcare, you know, or whatever.
And I think that the numbers around the child tax care credit, which, by the way, is the worst branded policy we've ever done. It's the most meaningful and the worst
right.
branding. Child tax care credit is a terrible name. But the kid cash, I'm going to call it kid cash.
I like it.
That it can basically, it nearly cut child poverty in half when they instituted it, showed to me, I think, hammered home something like more clearly than I'd ever really understood, which is that all of this is a choice and we could solve it if our leadership gave a shit. And until they do, it's a choice.
Well, that was one thing that we were. I mean, everybody was going around and congratulating themselves that they were going to cut child poverty in half by 50%. And like, sure, congratulate yourself, but also that means you know how to cut it
100%.
By 100%.
Right. Right.
And you've chosen not to.
Well, yeah. And that's
it's
how we pursue.
So disappointing.
Yeah.
It's how we pursue most policy. Is we're like, here's a small win that we are taking because we figured out how to do a big win, but we didn't want to.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So here's a smaller version of it.
Oh, man.
The other thing that's been going on with the conversation around Build Back Better is just like the most chaotic and worst messaging around the SALT deductions conversation. Everyone's losing. It's a conversation in which no one is winning. And then also no one understands what it's about, too. So in addition to no one winning, it's confusing and chaotic because you can't correctly message a policy that no one understands in the first place.
Right. This is one, including, you know, being able to deduct your state and local taxes from your federal taxes is a thing that some of the, you know, the mod squad snuck into this bill to
the
ensure
Gottheimers
that they
of
would
the
all
world are very excited right. about this.
Exactly. Yeah.
But so there have been a couple proposals running around about this, because I think some important context for why Democrats are tackling this is that the Trump tax cuts instituted a cap on SALT deductions that was designed specifically to target targeted wealthier residents of blue states specifically, because it targets people in high tax states and states with high property values. So while if you're wondering why Democrats are even tackling this in the first place, it's because it was a gotcha that Republicans put into law in 2017 and specifically targets voters in California, New York, and New Jersey, which is why you're seeing those coalitions or those representatives come
right.
together
That's
around
why
this.
Menendez was working on this in the Senate because
exactly.
Yeah.
So there are two schools of thought about how to handle this cap in a way that handles it at all. One is that the Josh Gottheimers of the world want to raise the cap from $10,000 to $80,000. And then the other is that Sanders and Menendez like have been working out some plan that allows you to, that creates an exemption for this deduction cap if you make under some amount that's always under, you know, it's around $400,000 because they like to use $400,000 as the middle class
right.
wage that none of us make.
Person.
But but something, you know, it's always in discussion because Menendez obviously would like it to be higher. The Tax Policy Center has said that that plan is certainly less regressive, but that both of these are basically plans that only benefit high earners. And I, you know, live in a high tax state and grew up in a high tax state and understand why the sort of mod squad is interested in tackling this issue, because obviously these are only concerns of like middle class and upper middle class property owners essentially in blue states. But that coincides pretty dramatically with the kinds of voters that Democrats reliably can count upon. So I can see why this has become an issue for a lot of big state blue state Democrats. But it has opened the door to Republicans accusing Democrats of cutting taxes for the rich and being the party of plutocrats. So the Republicans, who, again, created this cap in the first place specifically to fund tax cuts for the ultra-wealthy.
Right, and to screw over blue states.
And to screw over blue states.
Are now being like, oh, the Democrats giving all the money to the wealthy people.
Right. So this has created a completely unnecessary amount of messaging chaos for Democrats, who, of course, not up to the task of handling this particular call out, because this is exactly the kind of thing they would never be able to figure out in their lives. And essentially, they got played in 2017 in the first place, because now there is no way to get rid of this cap without it looking like a giveaway to the ultra wealthy. It's also, I think, something that is of concern. There's like an odd amount of overlap between Democratic voters and tax cuts for the wealthy on this one issue, because it only affects blue states and it only affects the sort of donor class in blue states. And so that's why you're seeing like Mikey Sherrill, Josh Gottheimer, like Andy Kim, like people like that are coming out in favor of raising the cap. They're also, of course, electing to do it in the most regressive possible way, because there are, of course, people in blue states who have gotten backed into high property values that don't actually make a lot of money. The property values exploded very dramatically in the last 20 years in a lot of these states. And so people who were able to buy, you know, in like 1985 are now sort of, you know, now often own homes that are worth millions of dollars that they did not pay millions of dollars for. And I get like why this is a concern for that group of voters. This is a big concern for my parents' generation in New York City, who like bought apartments in the 80s and 90s when it was like dirt cheap and no one wanted to live there. And now they're like, why am I sitting on this expensive property? It's like a 2-bedroom apartment. It doesn't seem like I can go anywhere. So like, what are we supposed to do about this? However, this is also maybe the worst possible messaging to put into Build Back Better on Earth, because it makes it possible for the focus to be pulled from things like universal childcare or even expanding the child tax credit, things like paid leave, and allows the Republicans to use a talking point that they created in the first place. This was always going to be a trap, no matter what. And we are just like, let's walk into that trap.
Yeah. I wish every time a Republican brought up the SALT deductions and all this, instead a reporter asked them, why are you opposed to universal pre-K? Why do you hate 4-year-olds?
Right.
Why do you want 4-year-olds not to be able to
read?
Exactly.
Like,
right.
I know.
What do you have against kids' books and Latin fun time at the library? This is one of the broader things that I think touches a lot of the topics we've covered, which is that Democrats are expected to govern, which means we have to figure out how. Republicans are expected to stop it all, so they don't ever have to come up with what that means or what they want in alternative. And they don't have to explain it. They just don't believe in any of it.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. I mean, that encompassed the entire repeal Obamacare conversation that we watched unfold over the course of like 10 years, where they just were like, we're going to repeal it. We won't tell you. We don't know yet. We're gonna let you know what the plan is to replace it.
Well, they said they were repealing and replacing.
Yeah, but they never gave us the replacement plan. They were just like, trust us. We are going to replace it.
Yeah.
We're talking about it.
This was only able to pass. It was supposed to pass on Thursday, but then Kevin McCarthy gave like a 9-hour speech on the House floor, which is now the record, broke Nancy Pelosi's record.
I love a House filibuster style speech.
Right, because they don't even have to. I mean,
so rarely get to do this kind of grandstanding. And I feel like a little political theater never hurt anyone. He said a lot of things that are going to be fun to quote for years to come.
I know.
I'm just saying it.
Did you watch any of the, I mean, I didn't watch any of it live because I don't hate myself that much.
No.
Although this does seem like something that I may have watched.
I was going to say, I once watched an 8-hour filibuster live in the Senate and I wasn't sorry about it.
Yeah.
No, absolutely not. I'm uninterested in what Kevin McCarthy has to say about this or anything else that man can just fuck off directly into the sun. It's a no from me.
I agree. Anyway,
I find myself strangely interested because he said a lot of things that really weren't on topic, that were just off the top of his
head. Well, you
have
to when you talk for 9 hours. You can't. It's hard to stay on topic for 9 hours. But there were a few things, you know, of course, the late night shows had a real field day with this. But I feel like there were because it was 9 hours, it took everybody a while to dig through some of these things. And there were some doozies in there. So we're just going to quickly go through a few of them.
Some of the important stuff to remember.
He talked about becoming a Republican in sixth grade. He said, quote, "I talk about what made me a Republican. I was in the sixth grade. I turned on the TV and I watched Jimmy Carter have on a sweater and tell me to turn the heating down."
This reminds me so much of the time that we saw Michelle Bachmann speak at Politicon. And she told us how she became a Republican. And it was that she had been reading the book Burr by Gore Vidal on a New York City bus and somehow taken the exact wrong message from it. Every story she told, she had just taken the opposite message of whatever she was. She sounded like she had tried to read every important book about American history and taken the opposite message from literally every single one of them. It was the most amazing speech I've ever heard anyone give that wasn't joking. In any case, he also had thoughts on China and fentanyl. That's right.
Right. He said, "I have a friend who serves in the Senate. He was sitting and having a communication. Maybe you have experienced this as well with a military general in the Chinese Communist Army." We have not experienced that, by the way, Kevin McCarthy. No one else has. "Do you know what that general said to him? America, you are weak. You are weak, America. Weak because you believe in God and you take fentanyl."
No, I'm really glad I went to bed early. I regret nothing about this choice.
Well, we're not done, Amanda, so settle in. He also had some thoughts on World War II swim meets.
Yes, that's right.
So I did not misspeak.
Yeah.
On responding to a question that he posed to himself about something that still remains unclear to me, he said, "Let me try and answer your question in an analogy of swimming. Picture America at a swim meet after World War II against every other country. We jump into the water. Not only do we win, we dry off before second and third arrive. So in the next year, we think that's a little unfair. The other countries got a little more destroyed than America." I don't even know where he was going with
that
point.
What was the analogy?
But the idea that
he sits around thinking about
World War II swim meet. Yeah. What a guy.
He went back to the famous Republican talking point of thinking that Donald Trump should receive the Nobel Peace Prize. The Nobel Peace Prize, I guess. This was the Nobel Peace Prize, I believe.
Right. And really mad that, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama got it, but not Ronald Reagan and Donald Trump.
No.
So.
Rude.
There you go. That's Kevin McCarthy.
Kevin McCarthy for nine hours.
On House floor.
We did not get any of the famous filibuster speech maneuvers that I enjoy, though. Like, I want a recipe.
Yeah.
If he's going to talk for that
children's
long.
Children's book, Green Eggs
I
and
would
ham.
Like someone to read me a children's book. Yeah. I mean, I have some standards.
Even
here.
The phone book, if you have to. It's less interesting, but like.
Yeah, but it's long. You got nine hours to fill. You can read the phone book.
Yeah.
What was he so busy with for that 9 hours? He couldn't have read us any of the phone book? Doesn't seem fair at all.
Oh, man.
They had to censure Paul Gosar because he tweeted, I don't know what is going on right now. This is obviously a door that Trump opened for everyone.
Well, of course.
Where you can like tweet doctored videos that are just like highly disturbing and completely inappropriate. And everyone
censures
you and
AOC,
then you're like, but never mind, I meant it. So here it is again.
Yeah, he tweets out a video of him killing AOC and then attempting to... It was like some anime.
It was an anime video too, so that was...
And trying to then stab Biden.
Sure.
And
as you do in anime.
And then he took it down and said, didn't apologize at all, but said something about like, oh, people were offended, so whatever. And then he got censured. And then an hour after he got censured...
That's the best time to retweet the video.
He retweeted the video.
He was trending. What was he going to not retweet the video while he was trending on Twitter?
Yeah.
Yeah, so he obviously learned his lesson.
God.
But... We also had Steve Bannon turn himself in. We had been speculating about how many collared shirts he would be wearing during the turn-in process.
Yeah. You're aware that he loves a double collar shirt, Steve Bannon. Yeah.
We had wondered if he would go with three for this special occasion.
We were hoping. It was just one and a jacket.
Which is incredibly rude.
It's disappointing.
Yeah. We were hoping that turn-in would be up to the entertainment standards that we have come to know from him.
He's a filmmaker.
Exactly.
Do better.
I believe that he considers himself a storyteller.
Photos would be everywhere. The dude is not an idiot.
Yeah. Oh man, this guy.
A real shame. Entered a not guilty plea.
He really had some tough talk.
Oh yeah.
Afterwards. He's coming for everybody.
He's coming.
Yeah.
Coming for us.
What did he say? He said, this is going to be a misdemeanor from hell for Merrick Garland, Nancy Pelosi, and Joe Biden.
Hmm.
So.
I.
What an Not sure who the villain is there.
I was going to say, I feel like I'm not sure what process he's referencing. Yeah. QAnon Shaman got sentenced too. So
yeah,
we were having a busy week with just like January 6th era people. He was sentenced to 41 months. Yeah. I'm very curious how many of those he's going to serve. Well, I'm also curious.
I mean, he's
how
been in for a year.
Much of his paraphernalia has been allowed in prison. Like, how does he maintain his persona in prison?
Yeah, I don't think
we didn't get an update about that, but it was a question that I had.
Yeah.
Or that I've had for quite a while, let's be honest. He's been, when he went into prison, I asked this question and no one ever answered it for me. So listeners, feel free to chime in again.
Yeah.
And then to put a bow on the week, the Kyle Rittenhouse verdict was just not guilty on all charges, which I'm sure you've heard if you're a person in America, like you didn't need us to report that news to you. We also don't have anything special to tell you about it news-wise because you have, like everyone else, watched 24 hours right. at least of coverage
just
of this.
Just be appropriately upset, I guess.
Be upset. Also, I don't know, this feels like a thing, and this is actually, I think, something that is perfect for this, the theme of today's episode, but judges are also elected a lot of the time, you guys. So just...
I was going to say here that this judge in particular, well, it was obviously a jury verdict. This judge in particular had been first appointed in the 80s and had run for re-election for the last nearly 40 years, almost every time unopposed. So
wild.
I mean,
if you would like to run for local judgeships
yes.
or any other position that brings right. about accountability.
You can't be less qualified than this guy. He was basically running like a mock trial for right. like a kindergarten class.
Phone was going off with a Trump rally ringtone. And I mean, right. he kicked out MSNBC reporters, I think, on the last day of the trial or something like that, because supposedly they were trying to take pictures of the jury, which, I mean, I just sort of have a hard time imagining. That's like rule number one of if you're covering right. trials that you know that you're not supposed to be doing. But certainly as a major news outlet like that. So
yeah.
I have a little bit of, I have some trouble with whether that actually happened or not. But yeah, I mean, yes, you're right. It was a jury trial, but also the judge got the verdict that he was hoping for.
Right. He was very clearly in the search of a specific verdict.
And he got
every
it.
Major media outlet was reporting that. So it wasn't like, that wasn't just like a thing that, you know, that just progressive media was watching or something. Like, that was a pretty mm-hmm. well-known fact about this case from the beginning.
Yeah.
And also, well, actually, along those lines, like, I think one of the things, you know, we do ballot guides for our friends around elections. We live in a state with a lot of propositions, but we also live in a state where periodically we're asked to vote on like 26 judges at once that no one has ever heard of, that it's impossible to research. Do you have any thoughts about how people can make more informed choices in some of those races that are very difficult to research and also less sort of less likely to have challengers that have a known brand or any like ability to really reach out to voters? I mean, these are very, these kinds of campaigns are generally done on a shoestring. They're not, you know, they're not necessarily well organized. They don't necessarily have staff.
I think it's a big problem. Getting past my bedtime too. It's 7 o'clock on a Sunday. Party animal.
Yeah.
I think it's a big problem across the Democratic Party, especially progressive spaces, that there isn't a really good arbiter for judgeships. It's part because it's really difficult. You know, these. How do you assess a judge without personally sitting in each and every courtroom and watching the way they govern and reading all the opinions and really like pulling out what is the facts in the case and what is the bias that they're bringing to the court? That being said, a lot of local newspapers do pretty good ballot guides. You can generally get a sense, maybe your local ACLU chapter might have something. You know, there are places you can find information. It's hard though. And if anyone here is a, you know, a billionaire with an inclination for judicial races, I think there's some opportunity to engage.
Listen, billionaire listeners of this podcast.
Right.
If you are listening, all the billionaire listeners.
You never know. Yeah, you know, never know who's in a room.
Tom Steyer, are you there?
There could be one person in a room.
We also had the excitement of a ceremonial presidency, first woman president, briefly. My favorite thing about this story, so Biden got like a colonoscopy or something on Friday, and because he was under anesthesia, he temporarily transferred power to Kamala Harris. So we had our first female president. Very exciting. I feel like the most important and underreported fact about this situation, though, was that Trump did not do this for Pence when he underwent his own colonoscopy and claims it was because he did it without anesthesia, which is just, well, A, obviously a lie. He's not a man who would sign himself up for a painful procedure without sure. anesthesia. He's a narcissist. He would never do that to himself. But also, I just love the idea that he did not trust Pence enough
like 25 minutes.
To give him 25 minutes of presidential power.
That the path to even the first acting woman president involved a camera up a man's ass. It's just like, it's poetry.
It's
so sad. It's so bleak.
I was hoping she would sign that student.
Right. Get in there and do some
student loan. Yeah, I was hoping she'd get rid of that.
$50,000 relief. Just
or whatever. Yeah.
Any amount helps.
10, 50.
Yeah, I mean, we talk about this a lot where, like, every time, in the same way that, like, if your company is going down the drain, obviously you hire a female CEO because that's the best time to experiment yep. with a historic first. Like, every time, it's like women only get historic firsts when, like, Andrew Cuomo has sexually harassed enough people that the entire political establishment is forced to disavow him. And it's like the worst woman they could have chosen in the entire state of New York. Or like, oh, Joe Biden needs a colonoscopy. So I guess that's the moment that we get 25 minutes of female presidency. Yeah.
You know, so, making sure. history involves a lot of bullshit.
Yeah. And that's the end of the podcast.
That's the news. Amanda, thank you so much for joining us. Where can people find you online? What should they do if they remind us again what they should do if they want to run for office, if they want to support Run for Something's work, etc.
So I am on Twitter too much at Amanda Littman, Littman with one T. You can find more about Run for Something. We're Run for Something Now on Twitter, Run for Something Now on Instagram, Run for Something on Twitter. We're at runforsomething.net. If you want to learn more about our broader work, you can always go check out our strategic plan. You can sign up for Run for Office. You can, of course, give us money. We welcome your cash, dollar bills. Mm-hmm. You can learn more about the book and the podcast and everything else that falls under the Run for Something umbrella.
Awesome.
Amazing.
Thank you so much for joining us. We will, of course, also continue to follow your work because it is always very exciting to us to, I don't know, watch young people like actually succeed at
doing it,
you know, like being involved in politics and you know, getting local, racking up those local races.
Thank you, and thank you for having me. This is my favorite thing to do, so I'm always glad to get to do it, even when it is wildly past my 7 p.m.
bedtime. Perfect. Come back anytime.
Yes,
you're and welcome anytime. We will be back next week with, well, just more news. That's how it works.
We'll be here.
So oh, and happy Thanksgiving to everyone.
Oh yeah, right.
Because I forgot.
Oh, so maybe we won't be here. Well, I don't know. No, we probably
here.
Will be.
What are we so
what
busy
are we doing?
With? On a Sunday after Thanksgiving, we could podcast. We could do anything
All right,
we want.
Fine.
All right. We'll talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.